Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Megan Kamrick, news director at KUNM. Controlled encampments or safe spaces for people who are unhoused to camp together are becoming more common around the country as housing costs keep rising. In Albuquerque, the city council approved the idea, then reversed course and passed a moratorium on them. In Santa Fe, plans for a safe space at the Midtown campus also hit opposition. On this week's Let's Talk New Mexico, we're looking at managed encampments and we want to hear from you. Should cities consider this option? Why or why not? You can email us at letstalk@kunm.org, call us at 505-277-5866, or you can follow us on Twitter and send us a note there. You can use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Today, we have city officials from Santa Fe and Albuquerque and a state advocate on homeless issues. But I want to start our conversation with Nicole Martinez. She's executive director of the Mesilla Valley Community of Hope. Nicole could not be with us live this morning, but I spoke with her about how her organization was formed in the late 1990s to help unhoused people. It provides housing and income support programs, and it created a tent city in 2011 called Camp Hope that has become a model for other cities looking for interim solutions to the housing crisis. Camp Hope sits on city property in Las Cruces, and it has a healthcare center, food support, a daycare center, and other comprehensive services for about 50 unhoused people at any given time. Nicole says the oversight of the camp falls to a mix of staff and residents.
So many of the decisions are being made by camp residents who have been elected to be camp managers. They're elected by their peers at the camp and then approved by Community of Hope staff. And then the camp managers form a safety team. So there are a few people sharing the burden of watching over Camp Hope, receiving donations, ensuring people are doing guard shack duty, making sure bathrooms are being cleaned, that incident reports are being written, and that they're communicating all of the happenings and incidents with Community of Hope staff.
Why was it important to set up a structure like that versus having a security guard there or a security team?
Community of Hope is invested in housing options for people, and we feel like that is our ultimate goal in ending homelessness. And so we wanted to make that our focus instead of building a 24/7 shelter system. We also felt like a very important piece of that was autonomy for individuals who are living at Camp Hope. It brings empowerment. It gives them, you know, skin in the game, a stake in what is actually going on. And we feel like those are really good steps, too, for people who are considering going into housing and you know, going back to having to live with a lease agreement and with neighbors close to them. So this is sort of a smaller model of that so that they are more prepared to go out and accept all of the responsibility that comes with their own unit.
Do people have to be clean and sober to come in?
People do not have to be clean and sober to come in. We do have parameters around alcohol and drug use on the campus and in Camp Hope. It's not allowed per Community of Hope, per city regulations, and per the camp residents themselves is asking for that to be a rule. Now, what our residents are doing off the property, we recognize that people are adults and what they're doing is their business. They do not have the luxury of doing those things in the privacy of their own home. So if they come back to Camp Hope and they do not cause any problems, even if they're not sober, they are allowed to go to their tent. They are allowed to use the bathroom. And it's not that we don't care about what's happening or look the other way. In fact, we feel like that's an opportunity to establish trust and rapport with clients so we can work with them if a path of sobriety is what they are looking toward. But we have really tried to model Camp Hope around harm reduction model to be very low barrier and honestly, to know our audience and the people that we are working with. We're working with a lot of people that do have substance use issues, mental health issues, and we want to address those and we want to keep them close to us and close to services so that we can help with that.
Do you have a sense of the success rate in helping people transition to more stable housing out of the situation?
Metrics are an interesting thing with Camp Hope, and a lot of times people want to see those metrics, and we sort of seem to, as a society, to have a predefined measurement of that, that the a success is that, you know, somebody comes into Camp Hope and then maybe gets a job or gets housing. And while those are very notable things and things that we do wish for every client that comes through, we also feel like one person who was kept safe overnight without sexual assault, without a physical assault, without having to go to jail, without being trespassed or fined and ticketed for urinating in public, we feel like those are successful measurements of what's happening with having Camp Hope there. And our ultimate goal, again, is to transition as many people as we can into housing and help them with wraparound services and the income support that we have here. Last year, we also opened a 40-unit apartment complex with our partners at the Housing Authority, where we transitioned 40 people into their own apartments, almost emptying Camp Hope. That was a unique experience. So in real time, it takes a lot longer to transition people, and it's really one at a time.
What was the initial reaction to all this from the community?
We were very fortunate to have the space on an existing campus that assists people experiencing homelessness. So in that, our experience is a little bit unique, whereas I know in other communities, they're trying to find a place and they don't necessarily have a nonprofit that's already established with all of those services to draw from. So for us, it was just literally putting the encampment in our backyard. So it was not, it made a lot more sense for business owners, you know, that were maybe in downtown saying like, yes, please, can you help with all the people sleeping in our doorways? Can you put them in your backyard? That would really help our community. It would also help with the foot traffic back and forth. And so we were, like I said, you know, more unique in that way. However, we did experience our own NIMBYism, not in my backyard, with some of the surrounding business owners that were very close to the community of Hope. So when it did go to council, we did have some people that were very uncomfortable and had experienced unpleasant interactions with our unhoused patrons. But we argued that it was the people that were not in the camp that were causing the problems, the people that were not appropriate to stay at Camp Hope or who were also causing problems for the community of Hope. So there is still a pocket, you know, of people that either disrupt from Camp Hope or will not opt to stay at Camp Hope that do cause some of our businesses, some of their customers, some unpleasant interactions. And ultimately, the Planning and Zoning Committee and our city council felt that it wasn't the people that were at the camp causing those problems. And so they were willing to go forward with the implementation of the PUD.
I was wondering if you could share maybe just what you've seen in terms of how getting this a little amount of stability has helped some of the people that you've met over the years. Just give us a picture of that.
One of the things that always occurs to me several times throughout the week as we operate Camp Hope is that I am willing to continue to run a project like Camp Hope as long as we have the buy-in from the people that we are serving. And time again, we have seen that happen. Even just with, you know, somebody who is staying at the camp, who is experiencing crisis themselves, who is undergoing trauma, because we would say that homelessness is a traumatic event, that they are willing to step up into an authority position, a very heavy position as a camp manager. Just seeing that resiliency in people time and time again has really showed us that, you know, we do have people that are engaged in services. We do have people that care about their community. We do have people who care about their neighbors. We've seen so many people transition into their own apartments and come back and volunteer at Camp Hope, maintain those friendships and that relationship, who have a vested interest in making sure that Camp Hope is successful. In the beginning, when we started Camp Hope, we had a lot of phone calls. You know, I was on call 24/7, and it was all the time because we were trying to figure this out and we were trying to make it as safe as possible. Now, most of the calls I get are about, oh, the soup kitchen left a door unlocked, the food pantry left a door unlocked. And it's the camp managers and the safety team and those who are staying there that are on the guard shack duty that are going around and checking the entire campus. And if they see someone who's on the property that's not supposed to be there, they act as a peer for that person. while they do have to ask them to leave and try to register for Camp Hope in an appropriate way, they can also say, like, hey, if you can't stay here, here are some places we know where you can go that might be safe for you. Here's, do you need a blanket? Do you need some water to take with you? People will come up with their pets and they'll say, here, we have some extra dog food, or do you need a sleeping bag? Those kinds of things are happening. So they're not only giving to, you know, receiving services and taking, like a lot of people think, but they are helping others to also get back on their feet and giving them the things they need to be safe and successful.
Do you allow pets?
We do allow pets. That was another gap we saw in the services, sheltering services in our community, which were very few to begin with. But one of them was that, you know, people couldn't have pets with them. Our rules around pets are that if you come in with your companion, that's okay, companion animal, but you are not allowed to adopt while you are at Camp Hope. No adopting animals. We want people to focus on their path and themselves. It's also a lot harder to get into a unit because you have to pay a pet deposit, and it just adds another barrier into ending homelessness.
What do you say to people who say this isn't a permanent solution? We need housing. We shouldn't do this.
It's a valid question. It's something that we grapple with as well. And it's one of those things where while we do help other communities to establish outdoor encampments, if it's viable for them, we don't blast it from the rooftops only because we do not want to lose the focus of housing funding. So I think that it's a valid argument. However, we already have encampments. They're already here. We have so many people outside. Why wouldn't we work toward merging those ideas, sheltering people that's tied to permanent housing solutions? This has to be an entire spectrum. We can't just look at the end goal and then sort of think that we're going to draw everybody in if they're scattered or if they are unsanctioned or don't have those wraparound services. So I would say that there has to be a good mix and this allowance for sheltering people and keeping them safe and close to services while you do tie that and look forward for permanent supportive housing solutions.
That was Nicole Martinez, Executive Director of the Mesilla Valley Community of Hope in Las Cruces. You can find more about the organization at KUNM.org. I'm Megan Kamrick. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We're talking about managed or controlled encampments, sometimes called safe spaces. These vary from places where people are living out of their vehicles and can park legally to camps of tents or small shelters where ingress and egress is managed and there are wraparound services to help people with income supports, medical issues, child care and mental health, and substance abuse problems. The Albuquerque City Council was moving forward with an ordinance to allow such spaces, but reversed course this month and voted for a moratorium for at least a year. In Santa Fe, there is an upcoming town hall planned for August 30th to discuss encampments after there was pushback from the community around potential plans to create such a space at the Midtown campus. Do you think cities should consider these as options to the uncontrolled camping that's already happening? Or should they invest time and money in other solutions around homelessness? Have you ever had to camp on the street yourself? What was that like? Would you go into a so-called managed encampment? Give us a call at 505-277-5866 or email us at letstalk@kunm.org. And we are also live tweeting the show. You can follow the hashtag letstalknm and you can give us your thoughts there. And we will jump back into this topic right after this break.
The Law Office of David C. Kramer supports KUNM. David Kramer represents consumer rights against banks, professionals, and companies and offers bankruptcy assistance. Complete details at davidckramerlaw.com.
Support comes from James Corinchian Public Relations. Specializing in strategic communications and reputation brand management, JKPR helps local, national, and international companies navigate through changing business climates. More at jamescorinchian.com.
Music can help us tap into our deepest feelings.
It's about all of those different connections that the mind and the body and the spirit makes when you hear a performance that moves you.
Clarinetist Anthony McGill and pianist Gloria Chen with new music by Jesse Montgomery on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. We are talking about the idea of managed encampments for people who are unhoused. Right now, among our largest cities, only Las Cruces has one of these. We heard from the executive director of Camp Hope in the first part of the show. And I'm joined live on Zoom today by Julie Sanchez, director of the City of Santa Fe's Youth and Family Services Division, Alexandra Ladd, director of affordable housing for the City of Santa Fe, Elizabeth Holguin, deputy director for homeless solutions and clinical advisor for the City of Albuquerque, and Alex Paisano, director of Albuquerque Coordinated Entry System with the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness. And Alex Paisano, I wanted to start with you. Some people in the community are concerned about creating managed or controlled encampments. We just heard Nicole Martinez talk about Camp Hope. This sounds very different from what we saw at Coronado Park here that was recently cleared out by the city, which was not a managed or controlled encampment. Why is there a disconnect? I think people sometimes conflate these two ideas.
I think part of the problem is that some of the people, like some of the city councilors who initially wanted safe encampments didn't fully understand what they were. And so when people started comparing it to Coronado Park, I don't think they themselves actually fully understood the difference between what was happening at Coronado Park and what an sanctioned encampment was. So I think that's one of the big reasons.
And Alex, why has homelessness been increasing in New Mexico? What have people that your organization works with told you about their stories?
There's so many different stories, but one of the biggest things we're seeing right now is people who just can no longer afford their housing. I talked to someone just yesterday at Coronado Park who's been camping there for 2 weeks because initially she had an apartment just down the street. But then her roommate had to move out and she could no longer afford to be housed on her own. And so now she's homeless. And we're seeing that a lot with senior citizens or single parent families who housing, their rent has come up in some instances 40%, and it's just not feasible for them to keep paying that. So they have to leave. And, you know, there's not enough shelter capacity for a lot of people. So they're either camping on the streets or they're in their cars if, you know, they're lucky enough to have a car to camp in.
Some people don't want to go to shelters.
Yes, that's true.
Why is that?
I know from a lot of the first-time homeless we've been talking to, there's a lot of stigma around what a shelter experience would be like. And, you know, everyone's concerned that it's going to be dirty or everyone's going to be doing drugs, that they're going to be attacked there, and not that those things haven't happened for some people, but that's not the case at every single shelter. There's just a lot of fear around it. And then other people, it's due to past trauma. Like our Westside shelter, for example, is an old jail. And for some people who have been incarcerated, that's a very triggering thing for them to go into that shelter space. They can't handle it. You know, we have some people who have other issues, PTSD, anxiety, and it's just too overwhelming for them to be around such a large amount of people in that dormitory setting. Other people, like Nicole had mentioned, you know, some of the shelters don't allow pets. Some people aren't willing to part with their pets, and that's totally understandable. And other times we've had, you know, older couples who are just couples in general where, you know, they can't be together in the shelter setting and they don't want to be apart from each other. That's their comfort.
Mm. You mentioned, I've heard you say first time homeless as opposed to somebody who maybe has more longevity on the street. Are you seeing more of that?
Yes, we are definitely seeing more first time homeless and, you know, It's a very scary situation. We get these calls every day on our helpline where, you know, people are getting evicted. They can't afford their rent and they're terrified and they want to know where they can go when they need something immediate, a new apartment or assistance paying their rent. And unfortunately, that just doesn't really exist in the space and time. You can apply for rental assistance, but it takes a long time and it usually takes longer than the amount of time you have before you're going to be evicted.
And as we heard, Camp Hope does not have a requirement to be sober coming in. This could be problematic for people who control zoning and money in cities. What do you think about that?
I think it's fair to use a harm reduction model. A lot of our people on the streets who are using substances have experienced so much trauma. Some of our clients, just that's their coping mechanism, and to expect them to just completely stop cold turkey is, it's not really fair. And it's also really dangerous for a lot of our clients.
I want to bring in an email from a listener, Irene. It's very long, so Irene, if you're listening, I hope it's okay that I summarize it. She wrote she was homeless and lived in various places outside. She was waiting on her pandemic stimulus check and unemployment insurance and had no felonies, but she faced a lot of danger and she tried various strategies to protect herself. She writes, I just needed somewhere I could leave my belongings while I tried to look for work. I needed a stable place to return to rest my head where I didn't have to sleep with a machete, mace, and taser under or near me for emergency protection from danger. It would be a great change for Albuquerque as far as somewhere safe, a place to wash up and to use the restroom, to sleep away from people's houses and businesses and properties. It would be a designated place to be instead of homeless, just randomly choosing places to stay until the city makes them leave. And Alex Paisano, you recently co-wrote an editorial in the Albuquerque Journal where you said, quote, the people who are currently experiencing homelessness are the experts on how our current homeless response system functions. An effort needs to be made to provide equitable access to them, to provide feedback on what is working in the system and where we are failing. So how can we provide that access to people like Irene, who may not be able to go give testimony at city council meetings, for example?
I think first the opportunity just needs to be presented to them. There was a town hall meeting the other night on the west side, and I asked one of the senator that was present at the end of it, you know, homelessness was a major public safety issue that people talked about, and the discussion got very heated. Understandably, it's a sensitive topic. But I asked you, like, you know, was any effort made to even engage anyone who's living on the streets in this district to see, you know, what are their barriers? Why are they living in your parks? Why are they moving into your neighborhoods? And he said, as far as he knew, there was no effort made to connect to them. I mean, there's multiple ways that could be done. I mean, you know, publishing in the newspaper, you know, reaching out to homeless service providers, asking them to put out the word to their clients. Hey, let them know this is taking place. Can you assist us in getting them there or getting the word out about this happening? I mean, there's many ways it can be done. And as far as I know, no effort was made at all.
And Alex, the Albuquerque City Council recently passed a moratorium on managed encampments or safe spaces for at least a year. Your organization, the Coalition to End Homelessness, is circulating a petition asking Mayor Tim Keller to veto this moratorium. I did happen to talk to Mayor Keller yesterday during a tour of the Gateway Center. That's the hub for numerous homeless services the city is creating. And I asked him about your petition. Here is what he said.
What would be helpful is to have them supporting the Gateway Center and everything that we do. We need people to be petitioning to support activities. And so I hope that they'll keep doing that with everything else the city's doing.
But do you think you might consider a veto on the moratorium?
I'm considering all options.
Alex, your reaction is pushing for managed encampments exclusive of supporting efforts like the Gateway Center?
No, we also support building more shelters like Gateway, especially specialized shelters. We need more of, you know, we have some smaller shelters like Family Promise, which does an amazing job with families, but it's very small. I believe the capacity is around 14 people. So that's depending on family size, 3 to 4 families, maybe. You know, Barrett House is another incredible example of someone who helps families, but they don't accept like male head of households. So that leaves out a population. Joy Junction has a great program going for families, but there are other populations that really need help and we don't really have shelter space available for them. Youth, we have very few shelter beds and youth is a very vulnerable population. You know, some of our, you know, our trans clients who are unhoused may not always feel comfortable going to large shelter settings. They might be, you know, fearful of being attacked or not being accepted. You know, each little subpopulation has unique needs and it would be nice to have shelters that met their needs as well as safe encampments for people who, even if there was a shelter available, still may not feel comfortable going into that space.
I want to take a caller right now. Terry from Albuquerque is calling. And good morning, Terry. What did you want to ask or say about this topic?
That was actually a very good segue. I actually work. It's not a youth shelter. It's actually a youth transitional living service facility. So what we are, we obviously don't, because we do work with the under 18 population, we do protect HIPAA, so we don't share the address, but people who need to know where we are. We actually work with ages 16 to 21, And I want to add that we're not like an emergency shelter. Basically, we're an apartment complex that can house 12 youth. It's a four-month program. And I describe it as a soft place to land. Like, you can have housing for 4 months. We'll help you get connected with medical care, get your social security, ID, help you apply for other more long-term programs, just whatever the need is. The frustrating and heartbreaking thing for me, because let's face it, doing this work, if you stop to think about for more than 5-10 minutes, you're going to cry, is we have people who call us and they need help. Some of them are in domestic violence situations. Some of them are getting kicked out by their families in 2 weeks. Some people are sleeping in their car, unfortunately. But what happens is if they don't have access to a regular cell phone or a phone number that we can call them back on, or internet access to check their email, we lose them. So someone will call us needing help, we'll do an application, we'll call them back to schedule like a Teams meeting or a Google Meet interview because of the pandemic and all that stuff. But often we lose them and they just disappear. And we always wonder what happened to that youth. So the frustrating thing for me and a lot of my coworkers here is that the only ones who are able to follow through with receiving our services are the ones who have already access or who already have access to a social worker, either through an inpatient treatment program or perhaps one of the other long-term programs or even like a school counselor at UNM, CNM, or a high school.
Mm-hmm.
And my worry is I think about what happened to that young lady who's 19, who was being kicked out of her house, and she couldn't charge her phone. We take for granted that we have access to charge our phone, that we have self-service, that we can go and use a computer with internet. And it would be really great to have a place where people experiencing homelessness can access those services, if only to connect with programs like mine and other programs that could help them find a more long-term solution.
Thank you so much, Terry. Really appreciate your call this morning. We have another caller, Sherry from Albuquerque. You wanted to talk about folks who are unhoused having access to public meetings and decision makers.
Hi there. Thank you for having this program. Just, you know, the last, I'd say, 5 years, it's so frustrating to see the administration flounder in addressing people in our community's needs. And people like myself, and there are multiple people in this community that have experienced chronic homelessness, addiction, all these sorts of things. And we never have a seat at the table. You know, the solutions that are needed, it's not rocket science. It's really simple solutions. You know, and since I'm an artist, I think of, you know, wild ideas that maybe could help people get insight into what the experience of not having a home is like. You know, I was telling my friend that maybe I would have a boot camp where I'd take 5 community members and we would, you know, not have a home for a whole 24 hours. And I think just that small experience would gain some insight into why people might need to use drugs and alcohol, you know, so it's infuriating to see programs like the Tiny Village, you know, uninhabited because of substance abuse. If people design and pour so much money into this project and they didn't think about substance abuse, there's a huge problem with administering, you know, these are vast amounts of money that is just being squandered that could be directly tuned in to people's needs, and we could experience, you know, transformation you know, it would be remarkable.
Well, thank you, Sherry. I will add the Tiny Homes Village is a Bernalillo County project, and you are right. They had, when it opened, a requirement that you had to be clean and sober going in. As I understand it, that is being revamped. So I think they heard some of that criticism. I don't have a person on today from Bernalillo County, but thank you for all your comments there, Sherry. Really appreciate it. I want to bring in Elizabeth Holguin in our conversation. As I mentioned, she is Deputy Director for Homeless Solutions and a Clinical Advisor for the City of Albuquerque. And Elizabeth, I would like to also read another email we got from a listener, Josh. He says, as a property owner and manager in the city of Albuquerque, I feel like the city's response to the homeless crisis is lacking. Organized camps may be an eyesore to some, but without infrastructure and services like tiny home villages and job placement programs, those experiencing homelessness will just camp in our neighborhoods. This is far more damaging to our sense of community safety than designating a space for these people to live. I have compassion for those in our society who do not have the means for stable shelter, but as my property taxes continue to rise, I take issue with the city's lack of meaningful response. This is a civic and societal issue, and the city needs to pivot towards managing the needs of the unhoused as it affects us all. So I know in your role, you are not on the political side of the debate around encampments, but you can talk about what the city of Albuquerque is doing currently. How can you talk about how officials do deal with people camping now in parks and other areas around the city? And if you want to respond to anything that we heard from our callers, please feel free to do so.
He's spot on. We can't have uncontrolled encampments with no rules or regulations, which is why we saw safe outdoor space as a really great solution and alternative to places like Coronado Park or unsanctioned encampments, because it does provide a structure. Seeing the cleanouts every couple of weeks at Coronado for public health and environmental health reasons is absolutely heartbreaking. To see people having to pick up everything they own and moving it somewhere for the day, I mean, I can't imagine it. So these spaces would allow people to stay where they are at and become somewhat established while having the requirement to work on either a job training, housing pathways, or rehabilitation, whichever they might need or choose to do. And yes, we did learn from the county and tiny homes that we must be as low barrier as possible, which is why we would allow substance use within the tent, but nothing visible, or obviously no drug trafficking, no weapons, things like that. So he's absolutely right about those needs. And as far as encampments, we have an encampment outreach team that our Department of Family and Community Services funds, but they're housed within solid waste to be able to partner closely for those responses. And our colleagues at the Community Safety Department also do outreach, and we provide notice before encampments are cleaned. For example, if we were going to clean something on a Wednesday, we would start on Monday doing outreach to people and offering services and resources. There's also plans to increase the amount of encampment teams so that we can divide the city by the four quadrants and have a team for each quadrant to help with that response.
We did hear from a listener who interacts with folks who had been camping at Coronado Park, and they sent us this. Residents were given less than 24 hours notice. Now there are many people who are fanning out in the surrounding neighborhoods looking for places to camp. I just got a call from one of my unhoused friends, has no idea where to go, fanning out into neighborhoods. Also, the city said everyone would be given vouchers, but I do not know anyone who actually got one, including a pregnant woman. One of our regular visitors said he doesn't know anyone who got a housing voucher either. Elizabeth, can you speak to any of those concerns? Also, perhaps talk about mistrust and how that hampers getting folks help?
So we gave everybody our regular notice. The last cleaning, I think what they may be referring to is some people weren't aware that the park was actually going to close that day, but we also didn't know. We were kind of judging it by the process, and it seemed to be a very controlled clean out. A lot of people were already out at that point because of our outreach. We had really ramped up with our service provider partners outreach in the prior weeks. So many people did know it was coming. They might not know it was that day. We did not say we can offer vouchers to every person in Coronado Park. One program in particular, Street Connect, does provide a lot of motel vouchers for the most complex clients that they serve, and they get them kind of stabilized medically and on that pathway to housing. Other people we are locating that have housing vouchers, and we are going to begin an intensive case conferencing approach for those that are in Coronado Park this Friday, tomorrow actually, and every Friday going forward. So we believe that if we can collaborate more, we can pool both our financial resources, but also our thinking around difficult, complex cases.
Many people do choose to camp in parks, but others camp on private property or sidewalks. And over the last 2 years, I've heard stories from many of them at the soup kitchen where I volunteer that they're given very little time to move by police, and they often lose important documents and keepsakes. How does the city work with folks? I'm sorry. How does the city work with police and private property owners in these situations? That's very different, right, than a city-owned park.
Yeah, so we have an encampment policy that we share with our department, family and community, and solid waste, community safety, and parks and recreation. And APD has been working on a new special order, which is under review by the DOJ. But that we've worked really hard. I know our city attorney has worked hard to make sure that those policies mirror each other and have the same consistent language. And within the encampment policy, we have a priority system. There's three different levels of priorities as to how the urgency around encampments being removed. So they may be discussing immediate hazards, where if it is on a sidewalk that's blocking people's view or like their pathway and forces them to step out into a busy street, or if that person in the encampment's belongings are now spilling into the street, causing possible barriers for drivers or those on bikes that could be a danger, that's an immediate removal. There definitely is no notice. But when we say immediate removal, still they will have someone from the outreach team at times try to come, depending on the situation, and just have them move under their own volition.
You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. Stay right there. We'll be back in just a minute.
Among the outlaws terrorizing the Wild West after the Civil War were a handful of Native American criminals and gang leaders. They often had colorful names like Cherokee Bill and the Apache Kid. Many were ruthless criminals. Some others were responding to colonizing pressures. We'll get to know some of the Native outlaws on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
KUNM wants to help our listeners in Santa Fe with the removal of old vehicles now that the junk vehicle ordinance is in effect. We just learned that any junk vehicles that don't comply with the new ordinance could be subject to fines, and we want to help. If you have a junker that needs to be removed from your property, just give us a call. We'll come pick it up for free and turn that old car into support for KUNM. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. Today, we're focusing on controlled encampments with services for people who are unhoused. It's an alternative to the existing illegal camping that often goes on now in cities. There's still time to call with your questions or comments, 505-277-5866. And you can also send us an email at letstalk@kunm.org. I did want to point out that Brian Egan from the city of Albuquerque wanted us to share that the Albuquerque Housing Authority will begin accepting pre-applications for Section 8 housing voucher programs, housing choice voucher, mod rehab, single room occupancy, other opportunities for housing. And we will get that on the website on the post for this show at KUNM.org. And I'm talking with Elizabeth Holguin right now with the city of Albuquerque. Elizabeth, how do you balance helping folks but also addressing concerns of property owners who might worry about what's happening in these unsanctioned camps?
Yeah, it's a very hard balance. I myself am a business owner downtown, so I definitely see both sides of the issue, and I have compassion for both. We like to say that we try to hold the line, but with compassion. And I think that the ability to have APD maybe have a little bit more freedom to do more enforcement than what has been happening is a good thing. But we also need to engage our outreach providers and ACS to help with any crisis triage in the moment, and really understand people's situations. And I think if we can have more time, like Alex mentioned, if we can involve more unhoused, I've tried to get unhoused to come and speak at the city council, because I think it really helps people to understand that it could be you or someone you know, there's just a few steps away from a really bad luck that can cause you to become unhoused. So just having that compassion and not making assumptions might go a long way in our working together towards more permanent solutions. And I did want to address, I know someone just called in from the city. We also, good news from the city council is that we received almost $15 million in new additional funding for housing vouchers in this fiscal year. And we're working really hard to strategize how to best us allocate all that and get that out the door. But with that, I want to stress it's not just $15 million in vouchers alone. It comes with lots of wraparound services, case management supports. We'll be investing in a landlord liaison to help and landlord mitigation fund for people. So a lot on that area, as well as sort of trying to preserve current affordable units before they're outpriced for
that's
people
good. Like That's good news. I wanted to take a call from Barbara in Albuquerque. She's experienced seeing encampments, having been people being chased off encampments, and said previous mayors didn't help in the long term. Hi, Barbara. Did I summarize that correctly?
So I just want to point out that I was involved with a group of people who helped a camp that I don't think it was probably more than 20 or 25 people, but during the prior administration, they chased these people around repeatedly from location to location. Our group provided a porta potty. The actual group itself had ground rules for how people would live in that community, and I think that self-governance of these communities is possible within the community itself to develop their own leadership skills and their own concepts of how they're going to live together and what sort of behaviors would be tolerated and how they would clean up and prepare meals together and all that kind
right.
of stuff. All of that thing was operational with the group we worked with. And yet they were chased from pillar to post to post to post to post and constantly evicted and tortured by the moving around. It was ridiculous. So I do want to say that I believe that people can become self-governing if they are allowed to develop their own leadership and ground rules for what is expected of the group. That's one thing I want to say. Another thing.
Oh, Barbara, I'm sorry. I have to jump to two other guests, but I really appreciate you saying that. We heard that model in the Las Cruces Valley of Hope that we talked to. And I'm so sorry to cut you off, but I have two more guests I want to get to from the city of Santa Fe. Julie Sanchez is the director of Santa Fe's Youth and Family Services Division. Julie, your role is, it's curious that you're in the Youth and Family Services Division, but I think it speaks to why you're involved in possibly looking at controlled encampments and homeless issues in Santa Fe and the many complicated issues around why people are unhoused. Could you just speak about that for a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. So interestingly enough, we are the Youth and Family Services Division, but we actually touch on a lot of health and human related service issues. So it's only natural that it would kind of end up in my shop. And we have a really vested interest in addressing issues of homelessness. It's actually how I started my career as a social worker in doing direct service with homeless and runaway youth.
And Julie, you have visited Camp Hope, the place we heard about in Las Cruces. Why did you think that would be a good model to look at doing in Santa Fe?
You know what? I love what Barbara just said about calling these groups communities, because that's exactly what they are. And the model in Las Cruces was incredibly eye-opening to how communities can really, how these, unsheltered individuals can create really safe communities. And that's exactly what Las Cruces has been fostering. And it's something that I think as a city, we can really set up and make successful for our unsheltered constituents.
There were initial plans to create this kind of space at the Midtown campus. Why was that a good spot? And why was there a lot of blowback around this by folks in Santa Fe?
You know, it was the most ideal location because currently the city actually set up a non-congregate shelter, Consuelo's Place, during the pandemic. They are a service provider doing a number of things for our unsheltered constituents. And they just would have been a great nonprofit to kind of host and oversee that encampment project, that Safe Sleeping Village on the Midtown campus. But we did have a lot of really genuine concerns from businesses and constituents. That space has been seen as kind of the revamped and redeveloped cultural gem, up and coming cultural gem of our community. And so understandably, Consuelo's, as well as some of the other leases on that site, are all temporary. And after seeing the La Masia Community of Hope Safe Sleeping Village, we really need a much more permanent solution. This cannot be something that's temporary, that's going to be moving around. And so finding an alternative location is really the best solution at this point.
So the city is still pursuing this idea, but you're not looking at this location. What are other options you're looking at?
So we have a lot of different options on the table. Interestingly enough, we have a lot of partners in the community who are really interested in seeing this become something very successful, because it's such a need in our community, as it's a need in all, I would say, all communities across New Mexico. We're tapping into different partnerships. We're looking at different options. And so hopefully we'll have something to present to the community over the next couple of months.
And is there such a place do you feel won't face the opposition from neighbors and businesses that you experienced? Does that even exist? Are you going to have to convince people that it can be safe and beneficial for the community?
I think there's always going to be some resistance. There's always going to be some folks that are, why aren't these people pulling themselves up by the bootstraps? There's always going to be those types of individuals in our community. But I think once we have a really successful model that's up and running, my hope is that it'll turn the hearts and minds of some of our kind of harder constituents, because, there won't be folks sleeping on the streets. There won't be visible encampments around our city. So
I also want to bring in one of your colleagues. Alexandra Ladd is director of affordable housing for the city of Santa Fe. Alexandra, how would something like a managed encampment work in the whole sort of ecosystem of affordable housing? It's not permanent housing, which is a criticism people have brought up about this whole concept.
Thanks, Megan. I just wanted to reiterate what everyone on this call has said, which is the importance that this intervention is part of a bigger system and an on-ramp for folks to transition out of chronic homelessness or get connected to services to get rehoused if they're experiencing temporary homelessness. So I think that we have a lot of work to do from the policymaker perspective in terms of educating how this concept fits into a bigger system. Right now, we are in Santa Fe struggling with housing costs. They're out of reach for much of our workforce even right now. So that creates an even bigger need for government intervention, for philanthropic intervention to look at what is on the inventory side. Like if it's one thing to get somebody stabilized in a safe sleeping space, but if they don't have anywhere to go from there, it's not necessarily going to do much good. It will keep them alive, of course, and that's hugely important in of itself. But I do think we've seen some great success with the non-congregate shelter model, which can be a more permanent, safer space for folks. But it also gets to what one of the callers was talking about, which is a safe place to keep your stuff when you're not there. So you can go out and look for a job, or you don't have to worry about protecting yourself while you're asleep.
How did the city's experience over the pandemic inform how you're thinking about encampments and housing options moving forward?
That's a great, great question, because I think, you know, bureaucracies don't typically move quickly or are very nimble necessarily. I think we also lack input from the people who are unhoused. We hear a lot from the people who are housed, and that's tends to be the pushback place for us, understandably, in some cases. But when we were faced with the question of how are you going to keep people from dying tomorrow from this scary, terrible disease, we moved quickly. And I think it showed us that we could do this. So we mobilized the dormitory rooms at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design / College of Santa Fe campus. And what we saw was that people who had never been successfully housed or hadn't been able to maintain housing, they suddenly, and I think it was to this whole issue of community too, from the very beginning, as soon as people had a safe place to sleep, they were offering to sweep the front sidewalk or do some weeding or just enjoying a sense of community and having a safe place to hang out and be around other people safely with masks on, socially distanced, because it was in the very beginning of the pandemic. But I do think that speaks volumes for how important it is to create these on-ramps into housing stability, and a sanctioned safe place to sleep is very likely a first step in that.
We did have, to that point, an email from a listener who said she's a landlord not willing to take a voucher from the city of Albuquerque unless the prospective tenant has been involved in some kind of transitional program. I'm hearing you say this can be a first step to getting people used to being in their own space and then build on that rather than just plunking them in an apartment.
Exactly, because that is one thing we've learned, is that the cost of housing is a huge barrier for a lot of people, but it's usually for, especially for folks who are in crisis or living on the streets or very, very low income, it's not their only challenge. And without the social services supports to go along with the affordable housing, it's really hard for people to achieve a long-term outcome that's successful for them.
We are almost out of time, but we had one caller, Sage, and I wanted to give you a chance to offer your comment this morning.
Yes, thank you. It was a great program this morning. And I just want to say thank you to everyone who has such a great heart for other people. And Albuquerque is a really good place with a lot of good people. And a lot of you are working, dedicating your time and sacrificing your time with your family. So I'm really thankful. And I do what I can with homeless people, coffee, whatever meals I can do, you know, especially the ones that have families. So I just want to say that thank you for this program. And one last thing, if someone could do a program on the success of all the work that's been done with homeless people and some that have been successful in living their lives.
Great.
Today. Thank you.
We want to hear about solutions. Thanks, Sage. Thank you. That is all the time we have today. Thanks to everyone who called and emailed to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Julie Sanchez, Elizabeth Holguin, Alexandra Ladd, Nicole Martinez, Alexandra Paisano. Let's keep the conversation going. Share your ideas on Twitter using the hashtag Let's Talk NM on Facebook. Search for KUNM Radio or email letstalk@KUNM.org. If you missed part of the show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Join us next Thursday morning when we'll be taking a look at New Mexico road safety for those not in a vehicle, including walkers and bicyclists. Do you feel safe on the road as a non-driver? What changes would you like to see? Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Taylor Velasquez took your calls. Bryce Dix live tweeted. Kaveh Movahed was in the producer's chair. I'm Megan Kamrick. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.
Among the outlaws terrorizing the Wild West after the Civil War were a handful of Native American criminals and gang leaders. They often had colorful names like Cherokee Bill and the Apache Kid. Many were ruthless criminals. Some others were responding to colonizing pressures. We'll get to know some of the Native outlaws on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.